Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. The war for the free world will probably be determined in no small measure by not some foreign battle or conflict, but what happens here in America in just about 2 months' time, namely the election of the next president of the United States. There is a lot riding on this election. We talk about it not in a partisan way, but in a policy sense on this program just about every day. What we're going to talk about today, I'm very pleased to say, in considerable detail with one of the country's leading experts on the subject, is the process by which that election will take place. Not just how it's supposed to occur, of course, but what might happen as a result of some forces at work at the moment. Our guest is Hans von Spakovsky. We call him HVS around here, simply because it's a handy way to describe a remarkable national treasure, a man who has devoted much of his professional life to public service, and not a little of it directly relevant to our civil rights, and specifically our most consequential right, arguably, that is to choose who will govern us through regular, fair, formally, you know, conducted and legal elections. Hans has been, among other things, a senior official in the Justice Department, where he served as counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. He has been a member of the Federal Elections Commission, and these days he manages the Heritage Foundation Civil Justice Reform Initiative as a member of the Mies Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation, where he is a senior legal fellow. He is also an author, notably a book directly relevant that he co-authored with John Fund entitled Who's Counting? How Fraudsters and Bureaucrats Put Your Vote at Risk. It is a delight to have him with us always, but most especially when he is able to give us generously of his time for the full hour as he is today. Thanks so much, Hans von Spakovsky, for joining us once again and for all you do, about which we'll speak in the course of this hour. Let me begin where we have often gone in the past, Hans, which is sort of a level setting. We are told with regularity, usually by the media, but often by politicians, most of whom seem to be Democrats, I think, that there's no such thing as election fraud. It just doesn't happen. And that, you know, there's no evidence to the contrary. Would you speak to that point as a way of sort of setting the stage for a conversation about, well, how it does happen and how it might well happen in a big way in the coming weeks?
You know, anybody who says that just wants to ignore the history of the United States. Look, we're a great country, but we have unfortunate aspects of our history. And it was in 2008 that the U.S. Supreme Court itself said, when it was when it upheld Indiana's voter ID law, it said the U.S. has a long history of voter fraud, and it's been documented by journalists and historians, and it could particularly make the difference in a close election. And that, of course, is the key. We have enough of it, unfortunately, that we need to be concerned about it. We need to take steps to try to prevent it from happening. And where it's most relevant is in close elections. And look, anybody who doubts that, again, we've got a database that we started just a couple of years ago at the Heritage Foundation, where I work, that contains a sampling of proven election fraud cases from across the country. Frank, we just added half a dozen cases to it. It's up to 1,296 proven cases from across the country. And that doesn't include cases like the four individuals who just a couple of weeks ago were charged with election fraud involving absentee ballots in Paterson, New Jersey, which recently held a municipal election, the results of which are so much in doubt now because of the fraud that occurred that a judge has ordered a new election. It doesn't include the case of a former U.S. congressman in Philadelphia who just recently was indicted by the U.S. attorney for paying an election official in a polling place to stuff the ballot box in multiple elections.
When you say cases, are you talking about individuals, or are you talking about, in at least some of them, much more serious examples of large numbers of votes being impacted, Hans?
It's both. I mean, our database has everything from, and this is the way election fraud unfortunately occurs. Look, some of the cases are just individuals taking advantage of the vulnerabilities in the system. As an example of that, not too long ago, we added a college student in who was convicted for illegally voting in more than one state. He lives in Massachusetts. He voted in Massachusetts. And in the same election, he also voted in New Hampshire, where he goes to college. On the other hand, we have cases such as the congressional race that was overturned in North Carolina just 2 years ago, 2018. Seven locals were indicted, including a political consultant who engineered it all, who basically helped submit and influence several hundred fraudulent absentee ballots. So, you know, some of the cases involve a lot of fraud. Some it's just individuals cheating the system.
Whichever it is, it's surely the tip of the iceberg, I think, is your basic premise, is it not, Hans, that this is hardly exhaustive, it's illustrative, and again, speaks to the preposterous claims that there's nothing to see here, folks, move along. And yet, it is so commonplace. I know it must drive you to distraction, having documented this with your database at Heritage, and of course, in your book, Who's Counting, and in much of the writing that you do on this subject, Hans. Where does this come from? Why is it that we're so relentlessly misinformed by both media individuals as well as politicians?
This is relatively new. 20 years ago, both political parties acknowledged that fraud occurred and were concerned about it. But what happened was that this is a narrative myth propagated by the left. It started with some voting rights organizations, or so they like to call themselves, including the NAACP and ACLU. And why did they propagate this myth? Because about 10 years ago is when folks started actually being concerned about this and started, for example, talking about proposing and passing voter ID laws. That's when Georgia and Indiana passed some of the first photo ID laws that required you to have a government-issued photo ID. And the folks on the left side of the political aisle are very much opposed to anything like that. And their way of fighting it, one of their ways, was to propagate this myth that there's no voter fraud, it never happened.
Hans, hold that thought. When we come back, I want to drill down a little bit on that voter ID business, because it does seem to me that this is so central to how you try to assure that there is minimal fraud in our key elections. Hans von Spakovsky is in the house virtually. We'll be right back with more with him, the author of Who's Counting? How Fraudsters and Bureaucrats Put Your Vote at Risk. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're visiting in this full hour of Secure Freedom Radio with one of the country's preeminent experts on a problem that we are relentlessly misinformed really doesn't exist. He knows it does. He's seen it firsthand. He has been chronicling it both in an important book, Who's Counting? How Fraudsters and Bureaucrats Put Your Vote at Risk, and through his writings at the Mies Center of the Heritage Foundation and in publications across the country, as well as, of course, his many appearances in the media. We're always grateful that he appears on this particular program. His name is Hans von Spakovsky. And Hans, before the break, we were talking a little bit about the importance of voter ID. It is claimed by its critics, who are many, it turns out, that it's a way of restricting the voting rights of Americans, that it actually is a means of interfering with elections, if not actually, causing voter fraud of some kind in its own right. How do you respond to that? And how many states actually have taken this important step to try to protect the sanctity of their voting processes?
Well, about two-thirds of the states have some form of ID, but the only ones who really have a good law on this and require a government-issued photo ID, there's about a dozen and a half states that do that. In other states, it's very loose what you can show. And look, it's a basic requirement. The left has opposed it, and you have to wonder why they would do that. Do they want to make it easier to cheat? Because what we do know is that it does not suppress votes. It does not keep anyone from voting, including minority voters, which is the claim they make. And how do we know that? Well, first of all, Frank, every single state that has put this ID law in place has put in a provision saying, look, if you don't have an ID, the state will provide one to you for free. Second, these laws have now been in place for more than 10 years. Like I said, Georgia and Indiana were the first states to do this. They were effective in the 2008 presidential election. So we have 10 years worth of turnout data in which we can compare those states with the ID requirements, both looking at their history of turnout and comparing them to other states like New York, which has no ID requirement of any kind. And guess what? Not only did turnout not go down in the ID states, in many of the states, it went up after their ID laws went in place. And so we know it does not suppress turnout. And look, the leadership of liberal organizations, they're adamantly against ID, but that's not what their constituents say. The vast majority of Americans, polling shows, and it doesn't matter what political party they're a member of, and it doesn't matter what their race or ethnicity is, an overwhelming majority of Americans think having to show an ID when you vote is just a common sense reform, which makes sense because try to think of something you can do in your everyday life where you don't have to show an ID. I mean, whether it's buying a beer at the local tavern, to getting on an airplane, to exercising other important rights like your Second Amendment right, you want to buy a gun? Try doing that without a government-issued photo ID.
Hans, I would assume that one of the reasons why this is so popular among the American people is not just that it makes common sense, of course, but that it actually is a question of whether you, as a voter, might be disenfranchised by having your vote probably more than canceled out by people who really aren't entitled to vote, who will nonetheless cast their ballots, and or, you know, people who are simply stuffing ballot boxes and the like. No,
no, that's absolutely true. In fact, you know, there's not universal opposition to voter ID, for example, the Democratic Party. And a great example of this is Rhode Island. Rhode Island actually entirely controlled by Democrats. They actually passed an ID law some years ago amid great controversy nationally. And the lead sponsor on it was an African-American state senator and also a Democratic woman who is also a legislator, Hispanic woman. And both of them said that they were sponsoring this law because the African-American senator, for example, said that people in his community were complaining to him that they saw fraud being committed. The Hispanic legislator said that she changed her mind about voter ID when she saw the same man come into her polling place twice in one day to vote under two different names. So it was seeing that happening in their communities that said, you know, we really ought to have an ID law.
So let's very quickly, we're going to come in some detail to the 2020 election, but there are four ways that I'm aware of, Hans, that voter rolls or elections are adulterated, shall we say, or simply stolen. And I'd just like to talk through them with you, if I could, quickly. Let's start with the voter rolls themselves. I know in Virginia, there have been documented examples of real problems with it. I believe Judicial Watch has found that in California as well. Give us just a sense of the magnitude of that problem as you see it, and its impact, again, on particularly close elections, which in some cases, these states that I've mentioned have witnessed, and others certainly have as well.
The problem with the voter registration rolls in the country is that states are not doing a good job of cleaning them up, not taking people off who have moved away or who have died. They don't verify the information. For example, if you register to vote and assert that you are a U.S. citizen, they don't actually check to make sure you are a U.S. citizen. And because states separately maintain their voter registration rolls, it's very easy to get registered in more than one state and get away with it. And to just quickly give you examples of this, a couple of years ago, the Public Interest Legal Foundation discovered that over 5,500 non-U.S. citizens had been registered to vote in Virginia. They had cast almost 7,500 ballots. And Virginia is a state in which, in the last dozen years, two state attorney general's races have been decided by less than 1,000 votes.
Control of the House, as I recall, was a coin toss, for heaven's sake.
Yes. And to just give you another quick example of the problem of people registering in more than one state, you may recall this. In 2012, there was a congressional race in Maryland in which the woman who won the Democratic primary, who was going to challenge an incumbent Republican congressman. Her name was Wendy Rosen. Somebody in her own party did opposition research on her and discovered that she was registered to vote both in Maryland and Florida and had voted in both states in multiple elections. Now, she was forced out of the race. She pleaded guilty to voter fraud. But the point of that story is that election officials didn't discover this. If she had not run for office and somebody did opposition research on her, she probably couldn't have gotten away with this for years. But that illustrates the problem.
And this raises the further question of one of the mechanisms by which these rolls are contaminated, shall we say, by people who should not be eligible to vote is through something called motor voter. Is that a serious contributing force to the problem you've just described, Hans?
It is. Motor voter is the law that said that you have to be given the opportunity to register to vote, for example, at your DMV when you get your driver's license, et cetera. It's not that we don't want to give people the opportunities to register to vote, but it provides opportunities for people to get registered who shouldn't. And it turns out that many of the non-citizens who registered in Virginia, how did they register? Well, when they went in to get a driver's license, they were asked, do you want to register to vote? They said yes. And the DMV people registered them to vote despite the fact that they knew these people were not U.S. citizens.
So this is a problem of government connivance, not just outside political operatives having their way with our electoral system. Hans, a second way in which this kind of fraud is apparently possible is through cyber attacks on the voting process. I have colleagues who are documenting some aspects of this in the last election cycle and warning about it in the next one from Texas. To what extent is that a concern, do you think?
Well, look, it's a big concern, and I know we're taking steps to try to make sure that doesn't happen. You know, the Department of Homeland Security is now involved in this, but I often wonder whether, for example, DHS has enough folks who they may know about cybersecurity, but I don't think they know much about elections and how we administer elections in this country. It's something we need to be very concerned about, and we need to take steps to guard against, because as you very well know, Frank, and you're really the expert on this, you know, foreign entities, particularly the Chinese government. And the Chinese government has an entire unit within the Chinese army whose only job it is to engage in cyber attacks on the U.S. government and other facilities here in order to steal information of all kinds. And if they could get into, for example, the computer network in a county government that counts votes in a key county, in a key state, in an election, they would do it in a heartbeat. And that's something we've got to guard against.
We have to take another break, Hans. This is another subject that I'm very troubled by, is the fact that in California, it is legal to engage in a practice called vote harvesting. Whereas when it was done by a congressional candidate's campaign in North Carolina, that individual lost the election as a result of what was considered, rightly, I think, to be voter fraud. We're going to talk more about that and its implications for the upcoming election, among other challenges we're facing in that regard, with Hans von Spakovsky, the author of Who's Counting? How Fraudsters and Bureaucrats Put Your Vote at Risk, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are having an hour-long conversation, I'm very pleased to say, with a preeminent authority on a matter that should be top of mind for all of us. As we approach, in just 2 months now, one of the most, if not arguably the most consequential election, certainly in our lifetimes, maybe in American history, will the vote be free and fair is a topic that Hans von Spakovsky has done a lot of thinking about and has made not a few warnings concerning. We're just working through four different ways that are of concern with respect to people in positions of power or perhaps people who are gaming the system can take advantage of our elections to defraud the American voters. And Hans, we talked a bit about the voter rolls. We talked a bit about cyber attacks being a possibility against the computer systems that manage or at least give us the vote totals. Talk a little bit about this practice of vote harvesting, as it's called, and why would that be legal anywhere?
Yeah, look, in states across the country, of course, people know that while they normally would vote in person, they can also vote through an absentee ballot. You can mail your absentee ballot after you've filled it out back to election officials. You can legally hand deliver it to election officials, or usually a member of your family can too. But in some states, they've legalized anybody can pick, come to your front door and pick up your absentee ballot and say they'll deliver it for you. Well, if you think about that, you realize what an unwise policy that is, because what that means is that candidates, campaign staffers, party activists, and political consultants, political guns for hire who work for campaigns, can come to your door and do everything from put pressure on you to vote a particular way, to try to coerce you to vote a particular way, to if you hand your ballot over to them, there's a possibility that they could alter it, they could forge it, or if they're in a predominantly Republican neighborhood, for example, and they're working for a Democratic candidate, take your ballot and trash it rather than delivering it. And anybody who thinks that doesn't happen, I'm sorry, but there are plenty of cases proving that, in fact, it does happen, like the North Carolina 9th Congressional District race that you and I were talking about earlier that occurred 2 years ago. That's exactly what the political consultant who's been indicted in that case was doing. Now, fortunately, North Carolina bans vote harvesting, so that made it easier to detect this and get an investigation rolling. But unfortunately, about half the states, including California, allow vote harvesting. That's a new phenomena in California. They used to ban it, but now they allow it to happen. And Texas, for example, has had a real problem with this. They have prosecuted a number of individuals down there, particularly along the South Texas-Mexico border, and they even have a name, if you can believe this, Frank, for the folks who are paid to go do this. They're called politiqueros, And those cases show that often they are the ones filling out the voter's ballot, not the voter themselves, which, as you know, is something that we don't want to see happening. And that's why vote harvesting is extremely dangerous and is something that should be banned.
I am right, I think, Hans, that it seems to have had a determinative effect in a number of congressional races, in particularly Southern California, I believe, in the last cycle. So it does matter, and it is another means of perpetrating fraud on the voting population. This brings us to the fourth of these, which is particularly top of mind at the moment, because it's the latest and perhaps most egregious example of a fraught practice, and that is universal mail-in balloting. Walk us through what that actually entails, Hans von Spakovsky, and why it has become such a cause célèbre for the Democratic Party in the 2020 election.
Well, they're pushing for either an all-mail election or a vast expansion of what they call absentee balloting. And the problem with what's called universal all-mail elections is that in those states that do that, it's not that the voter requests an absentee or mail-in ballot when they can't make it to the polls. No, instead, election officials simply mail a ballot to every single registered voter. Well, we've talked about the problems with the voter rolls, and you can see why that would be problematic, because it means that in states that do this, you're going to have literally thousands of ballots showing up in people's neighborhoods, in apartment buildings, in condominium complexes, folks who don't live there anymore, which means that those are ballots that could potentially be collected by vote harvesters who then try to vote them. And whether or not they're caught depends on how good election officials are in detecting, for example, that signatures don't match. And election officials aren't often very good at actually doing that. The other problem with this is that you're now depending on the U.S. Postal Service for your election. And we've seen in election after election after election, when it comes to absentee ballots, problems with that. Wisconsin, you know, held a primary April 7th. A lot of people were encouraged to vote by mail. The Inspector General of the Postal Service just released a report about literally, Frank, thousands of absentee ballots that were found in a mail processing facility after the election that had never been delivered to voters. So those voters were essentially disenfranchised by the Postal Service. In the last four federal elections, according to U.S. government records, almost 3 million absentee or mail-in ballots were returned by the Postal Service as undeliverable. And finally, the rejection rate for ballots that are mailed is much higher than the rejection rate for ballots cast in person. That's because it's everything from signatures not matching to voters not providing all the information they have to provide with the absentee ballot, to the U.S. Postal Service delivering the ballots too late or forgetting to postmark the ballot so there's no date on them so they don't know if they were voted before the election.
Hans, of course, the argument that the Democrats are making for doing this is that the dangers of voting in person are so great in the course of this coronavirus pandemic that you've got to give this opportunity to everybody. Two questions arise. One is, what has actually been the experience with voting, for example, in Wisconsin, in person, in the midst of this virus? Has there been some huge uptick in, you know, coronavirus cases or even deaths as a result? And secondly, I mean, just the mind kind of reels when you think about, what is it, something on the order of 90 million ballots are going to be sent across the country automatically and to everybody. You talk about close elections. What are the chances that there will be more than enough to throw any election anywhere in the country if those ballots wind up in the wrong hands and are, you know, without the appropriate people, the actual voters casting the ballots, nonetheless get their way into the returns?
Well, I mean, to give you an example of that, the New York primary occurred June 23rd, and it's a harbinger, unfortunately, of what may happen if we go to an all-male election or there's a huge expansion of absentee balloting. New York election officials and elected officials encouraged everybody to vote through the mail. They had a gigantic increase in absentee ballots, and it caused chaos and all kinds of problems. One in five ballots returned to election officials were rejected by election officials. One in five ballots, 20%. In New York City alone, 84,000 ballots were rejected by election officials for all kinds of problems, and not for not complying with state rules governing absentee ballots. 84,000 ballots. I think, Frank, didn't the president win Pennsylvania by only about 40,000 votes? So you can see those kind of problems could make a very big difference. Now, there's no reason we can't vote safely in person. How do we know that? Look, as long as election officials follow the safety protocols that have been recommended, you know, line spacing of the voters, people wearing masks, sanitation stations inside, outside the polling place, we can vote safely in person the same way we're all going to our grocery stores and our pharmacies. Wisconsin, yeah, a lot of people voted by mail, but over 300,000 residents of the state voted in person. There have been two medical reports issued about that election, one of them by the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, and both of them say there was no spike in COVID-19 infections because of the election.
The bottom line of it is this. What is being put into train, it would appear, I don't want to assign malevolent intent to elected officials, but it does seem as though there is, on the part of some, a desire for chaos to come out of this election, to have, at the very least, no conclusive outcome on election night. The president is warning about this. I think you have warned about this. I think any sentient being who's looking at what's going on here, the sorts of things that you're talking about, the actual record suggests that that's a distinct possibility. So have a short break we have to take. When we come back, I want to ask you about what that looks like, first of all, in practice, what it might mean, and most importantly, what can we do to stave it off? Hans von Spakovsky will answer those questions and more on the other side of this very short break. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to the fourth and final installment of our very special, very timely conversation with Hans von Spakovsky. Hans, you've given us a lot of food for thought about reasons why the deck is somewhat stacked against free and fair elections. It seems as though that may be, to some extent, at least on the part of some of those in the mix, by design. Would you characterize it that way if you look at what is now being set in train between the mail-in balloting and blocking voter ID and not cleaning up the rolls and not fixing the dangers of the potential, at least, of cyber attacks on our electoral system? And if there is a certain method, if you will, to the madness, what's it going to translate into in terms of the 2020 election cycle, do you think?
Well, I want to divide up between election officials, most election officials, and political actors. I think most election officials are well-intended, but I think, particularly in the last 6 months, they're being stampeded and railroaded into doing what I think are bad things, taking bad steps when it comes to conduct of the election. But I think there is, in fact, malevolence on the side of political actors, particularly on the liberal side, who I think want a chaotic election and want a situation where in a close election, they can try to litigate their way to success. Again, I take the New York primary as probably one of the best examples of this. First of all, it took New York 6 weeks to count the ballots. They just weren't equipped to handle the huge increase in mail-in ballots. Mail-in ballots take a lot longer to process and handle and count. So it took them 6 weeks. And then there was, as soon as we had an outcome, the outcome was contested through litigation. And the litigation was litigation filed by liberals saying, hey, it was improper to reject all these ballots. Basically, you should waive all of the rules governing absentee ballots. And that's been happening all over the country, Frank. All these lawsuits have been filed by the left to push universal or all-mail ballots, but then part of that is our provisions asking the states or demanding that the states, for example, get rid of the security protocols that apply to mail-in ballots. For example, in most states, you have to have a witness signature on the ballot so that somebody saw that you, the voter, actually filled out and signed the ballot. They want the states to get rid of that. No witness signatures. They're trying to get rid of the signature comparison provisions where election officials try to compare the signature of the voter on the absentee ballot. So they're trying to get rid of all the safety protocols, which will make it easier to cheat and submit fraudulent ballots.
Hans, I want to come back to what that would look like. But before we do, just to stay with this thought, it's hard, Hans, especially against the backdrop that you've painted for us, to come to a conclusion other than there really is malign intent on the part of folks who seek to maximize the opportunities for election fraud. And at the very least, as you say, chaos coming out of this, and chaos specifically in the form that there isn't a resolution, there isn't a president of the United States. There is uncertainty about who that will be. There will be, as you say, litigation, and I gather the lawyering up by the left has been going on a prodigious scale to assure that there is endless effort made through the courts to get judicial interference to determine the outcomes of what may well be a lot of close races. No?
No, you're true. And you can really see what's going on, this manipulation, by just this one fact. Look, at the very same time, the folks on the left are saying, well, because of COVID-19, we've got to have mail-in balloting so that people won't get infected when they get to a polling place. At the very same time they're doing that, they're trying to force states to allow vote harvesting. Now, Frank, can you think of a faster way of spreading COVID-19 than saying to a state, you have to allow strangers to go from door to door to door in a neighborhood to pick up absentee ballots?
What could possibly go wrong on either the election side or the public health side? It's fraught, obviously. So, Hans, come back to this horrifying prospect that there is no resolution of the outcome of, let's just focus on the presidential race, in at least some states through December, which means that I guess the Electoral College can't actually determine who the president is. Is that right?
Right. It takes 270 Electoral College votes to win. Let's assume we get to January 20th, actually, and each Biden and Trump have both gotten Electoral College votes from states who have resolved their election outcomes, but neither one has enough to be president. There are still enough outstanding states with the remaining Electoral College votes that we don't know who the president is. Well, in that case, this statute comes into play. A federal statute has never come into play before. It says that if the president, vice president have not been determined by the end of the president's term, which is January 20th, inauguration day, the acting president of the United States shall become the speaker of the United States House of Representatives, and the speaker will remain acting president until the outcome has been determined.
That would presumably mean that Nancy Pelosi would become the acting president of the United States, potentially for some period of time, not just overnight. This is about as horrifying a prospect to me personally as I can imagine. Bad as one might think Joe Biden is, I think personally Nancy Pelosi is worse. So the question occurs, given what you've forecast here, what can be done to try to prevent chaos, an upsurge in revolutionary activity, or simply a Pelosi presidency. I mean, the obvious thing occurs to me is, well, you need a landslide sufficiently large that it can't be stolen through one or the other or some combination of these means. Is that really the only way out as we now see things?
Well, a landslide would be good, or enough of a margin of victory so that we know who has won the presidency. But the key thing I would tell your listeners is that, look, right now, election officials all over the country, and remember, elections are run at the county level. It's county governments all over the country that actually administer the election process, with just a couple of exceptions. In Michigan, it's the local townships. Right now, they're making decisions on, are we going to open our polling places? Are we going to just have an all-mail election? And people should be calling the election office of their local county government and demanding that their polling place be open so they can vote in person, so that we're not dependent on the mail service. If enough people call demanding that, then election officials are going to be swayed to say, well, yeah, we really ought to open all our polling places. The other problem is they have trouble finding enough people to man the polls, to actually work as election officials. And I urge everybody out there, take the time to volunteer. You will get paid. The pay isn't that good, but volunteer to be a poll worker, somebody who's actually working in the polls, and get your kids to do it too. You know, if you have students who are in college, folks who've just graduated, convince them to do their civic duty and go work in the polling places.
Now, this is not the same thing as being a poll watcher. This is actually being an official who has some authority to make sure that the polling is done properly and fairly, right? And this involves some measure of training as well as, being officially appointed.
It does. Like I said, you'll find the county governments are desperate for poll workers. You'll have to undergo a day or so of training, but then you'll be actually working the polls. Look, we also need people to be poll watchers, but a poll watcher can do nothing but observe. Even when they see something wrong, there's nothing they can do about it other than report it. Whereas a poll worker, an election official, is the person who's running the polling place and making sure that everything is being done according to the law. And that's the top job. That's the top job that people ought to be volunteering for.
This is hugely important. I hope it is sufficient to assure the fairness and legitimacy of this election and that we are spared the chaos that might otherwise ensue. Hans von Spakovsky, I know if it does come out right, it will be largely thanks to your great work. And I know I can count on you to keep it up at the Heritage Foundation's Mies Center. How can people best follow that work, Hans, and get access to it?
Sure. If they go to heritage.org, we've got a page on, in fact, election integrity, and it includes not only everything I've written and recommendations we've made, but you can get access to our election fraud database. You can click on any state and you can find, like I said, a sampling of some of the voter fraud cases that have unfortunately occurred in your state.
Thank you, Hans von Spakovsky, again for joining us for this full hour. It flew by. We'll ask you to come back with updates soon, if you will. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Afty. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.